Okay.
Those are two impressive presentations. Let's hope the government of Japan is listening. And now, Arne Gundersen, what did they know? When did they know it?
Is there a clicker? Hi, thank you very much for coming. I'd like to especially thank Helen Caldicott, the Caldicott Foundation, and Physicians for Social Responsibility for sponsoring the meeting today. And for those of you on the feeds throughout the world, thank you for listening, likely at midnight in Japan. A downloadable PowerPoint presentation like I'm going to give is on the Fairwinds website for those of you in remote locations. And if you want to pull it down, go to Fairwinds. And there's also a Twitter conversation going on, as we discussed earlier, and also at Fairwinds on Twitter. Okay, let's buckle our seatbelts and get started. I wanted to talk today about when people knew there were problems at Fukushima Daiichi, both in the decades before the accident and then immediately after the accident. But before I do, there are hundreds of people at Fukushima Daiichi and at Fukushima Daini who I'd like to acknowledge as my personal heroes. This was an accident, a tragedy, and caused by a failure of technology. But what saved the day was human courage. So we have an example here of courage defeating failures in technology because of several hundred people who risked everything to save Japan and to save the world. And I am in awe of what they did. The sequences of the first two sections, I'd like to talk about what happened in 1965. What was known before this plant was ever started? And the second two presentations is what is known now after the accident. The Fukushima Daiichi accident was made in America. The reactor was designed by General Electric and built by a company called Ebasco. I used to go to the Ebasco offices right here in Manhattan when I was an engineer on Millstone Unit 1, which was almost identical to Fukushima Daiichi Unit 1. It was licensed by the Atomic Energy Commission, which at the time, in the 1960s, was the ultimate authority on nuclear licensing in the world. At least we thought that to be the case. This is not just a Daiichi issue. There's 22 other plants in the United States that are similar. And the plants in the United States are in some ways much worse because there's a lot more waste fuel in their spent fuel pools than there were at Daiichi. The engineers at General Electric and at Ebasco made six critical mistakes in 1965 that were to doom Japan in 2011. The first five critical mistakes all revolve around the issue of not really understanding the power of a tsunami. They reduced the height of the cliff that the plant was built on. They built a short tsunami wall. The diesels were placed in the basement. The emergency pumps, called the service water pumps, were placed in a situation where they were underwater. And finally, the diesel tanks were placed in a place where they, too, were flooded. These were engineers based here in New York City that simply didn't understand the power of a tsunami. The last issue on the Mark I containment is a little broader, and I'll get onto that as well. This is a picture of the cliff at Fukushima Daiichi in 1960. It was 35 meters high, about 115 feet high. The engineers at GE and Ebasco cut it down to 10 meters, so it was a 30-foot cliff. This is a picture after Daiichi was built. These areas here and here are at 35 meters. The area along the seacoast is at 10 meters, and this is an access road cut down in through earth to get the plant close to the water. Well, tsunami is a Japanese word coming from tsu, meaning harbor, and nami, meaning waves. The entire ocean rises up. If you're on a boat, you don't notice a tsunami because the entire ocean rises up, except when it hits a harbor, and then it becomes terrifying. It travels at close to the speed of sound. Engineers knew of tsunamis. And I thought I'd just go back 100 years in Japanese history to look at Pacific Coast tsunamis that hit Japan. In 1896, there was a 40-meter tsunami. 1923, there was a 13-meter tsunami. 1933, there was a 28-meter tsunami. And this was the tsunami of record as far as killing people before the Daiichi tsunami. 1944, there was a 12-meter tsunami. 46, another 12-meter tsunami. In 54 and 55, 10 years before Fukushima Daiichi was designed, there were three tsunamis, and all of them were over 13 meters. The tsunami that hit Fukushima Daiichi in 2011 was just a middle-of-the-road tsunami compared to the 100-year history before it. But in face of that history, the tsunami wall was built by American engineers at 4 meters and later raised to 5.7 meters. In addition, the diesels were placed in the basement. Now, diesels can be placed in the basement, but you should be able to put them in some sort of a waterproof container, which did not occur. It's important to know that General Electric built these first dozen or so Mark I reactors on what's called a turnkey contract. They took $60 million and built these plants, and they lost their shirt. I know because I worked on one of these turnkey reactors, Millstone 1, around the same time. So there was a lot of economic pressures on General Electric to keep the cost down because they were losing money dramatically on the dozen reactors they had built on this turnkey process. In addition, the service water pumps had to be at the water, but they were designed so that in any tsunami they would have been flooded. So it doesn't matter that the diesels were in the basement. If the diesels had been on top of the Empire State Building, we'd have the same problem because the cooling pumps that cool the diesels would have been flooded. In addition, the fuel tanks that provide fuel for the diesels were also in the floodplain. So again, it's not about the diesels being flooded. It's about engineers here in New York City, General Electric engineers and Abasco engineers, who didn't appreciate the magnitude of a tsunami. This is an example of the... this is the height of the seawall. And, of course, the pumps were totally inundated. The site was at 10 meters, but there was 4 meters more water on top of that. That's a 12-foot flood on top of Mother Earth. It was almost at the bottom of the control room. That's how much water there was on the site after the tsunami. Now, there's some political issues going on as well. General Electric, whose motto, by the way, in 1960 was "Progress is our most important product," said in 1961, they said, "We're going to ram this nuclear thing through." Their chairman is quoted as saying that. And ram it through they did. They met with the Advisory Committee on Reactor Safeguards, which in theory is an independent body designed to protect Americans in this case, but those design decisions were driven into the Japanese design as well. And Dr. David Ockrent, who was on the advisory committee, basically said that General Electric threatened them of going out of business unless the advisory committee continued with this Mark I design. Scientists in the United States, 1965, recognized that this Mark I design had flaws. And as Dr. Ockrent said, I think it was kind of a threat. Now, Glenn Seaborg was the chairman of the advisory committee at that time, and he actually has an atom named after him. He's got an element, a seaborgium, named after him. This is a heavy hitter in the nuclear industry. And he said, I don't think we had the power to stop them. Now, think about that. This is the United States government didn't have the power to stop General Electric's faulty design in 1966. Just about the time the Daiichi units were starting up in 72, there's a famous letter exchange with a senior scientist at General Electric named Joseph Hendry. And Mr. Hendry said that he had serious doubts about the Daiichi design, the Mark I containment. But as I've highlighted at the end, he said that he felt they should be eliminated. But in eliminating this Mark I design, quote, it could well mean the end of nuclear power, creating more turmoil than I could stand. So the turmoil he chose to avoid in 1972 became the turmoil that Fukushima Daiichi experienced 40 years later. So when this plant started up, a made-in-America design, this is Fukushima Daiichi 1, units 2, 3, and 4 aren't built yet. Fukushima Daiichi 1 was built by General Electric and Abasco on a turnkey project. There was no Japanese engineering on Fukushima Daiichi 1. All of the critical problems that Daiichi was to face 40 years later were in place. Essentially, the fuse was lit on Fukushima Daiichi in 1970, and it exploded in 2011. If we fast forward 40 years, this is the completed site right before the accident. And this is the tsunami hitting the plant. The earth sunk a meter, 3 feet, after the earthquake. The tsunami was 15 meters high. But remember, it's moving at the speed of sound. So the wave, when it hit the plant, actually crested at 46 meters high, over top of all these buildings. So how bad was it? The secret is in the assumptions. This is my favorite comic strip in the whole world. And for those of you who can't see it, I'll read it. It's a Dilbert. The pointy-headed boss says, I can do this feasibility analysis in 2 minutes. Dilbert's being asked by the pointy-headed boss, and he says, I can do this feasibility analysis in 2 minutes. And then he says, it's the worst idea in the world. Numbers don't lie. Then the pointy-headed boss says, but our CEO loves the idea. And Dilbert says, luckily, assumptions do lie. So the message is here, when we're evaluating the dose consequences of Fukushima Daiichi, the secret is in the assumptions, which is where I'll spend the rest of this presentation. Assumption one is that containments maintain their integrity. After all, they are called containments for a reason. They're meant to contain. No containment in the world is designed to handle a detonation shockwave. That's a shockwave that travels faster than the speed of sound. There's 440 nuclear reactors, and none of them can handle a detonation shockwave, a shockwave that travels faster than the speed of sound, because engineers believed that it couldn't happen. Well, right after it did happen, it's interesting that the NRC's own Chuck Castle, now he's a senior guy, he's in charge of the NRC's Region 3 out of their Chicago office, a very senior guy at the NRC said this, of course, that Mark I containment is the worst containment we have. And if you have something called a loss of offsite power or station backout, you are going to lose the containment. There's no doubt about it. So remember that Mr. Hendry at the NRC in 1972 said this was the worst containment in the world. And here's the Nuclear Regulatory Commission saying the same thing immediately after the accident. We've known for 40 years that this Mark I design, like a Daiichi, was an accident waiting to happen. Well, what does a meltdown look like? When I was in the industry, someone gave me some nuclear fuel rod. It didn't have nuclear fuel in it. And right after the accident, I heated it up to 2,000 degrees. This is what nuclear fuel looks like at 2,000 degrees. This is what was going on inside the reactors at Fukushima Daiichi when they didn't get their cooling order. That's pretty hot. Okay, this is a time lapse. I'll shoot through it really quickly. Fukushima Daiichi units. One has already exploded. It's on the far left. Then Daiichi 2, 3, and 4. Keep your eye on Daiichi 3 in the middle. Right there is the beginning of something that the NRC believes can't happen. That's a detonation shockwave. Right there. There's the building intact. There's the building erupting with a detonation shockwave. Now, this can't happen, so don't worry about it. These are time lapse of the detonation shockwave. And, of course, you've all seen the devastation that a detonation shockwave can occur. Containments were meant to contain, and this is not supposed to happen. Assumption number two is containment leakage. Now, Dave Lockbaum was on top of this back before the accident and certainly during the accident, as was Fairwinds. What happened inside the Daiichi reactor was that the pressures got so high that the bolts that hold the containment together began to stretch. And hot radioactive gases and hot radioactive steam began to leak out, and hydrogen. Now, in addition to the hydrogen that was created in the fuel, there was already a meltdown in process, and that fuel was now lying up against concrete. The concrete was liberating hydrogen as well. So we had two sources of hydrogen after the Daiichi accident. The fuel, as it created something called a Zirk water reaction, zirconium water reaction. But we also had the meltdown was causing more hydrogen because the hot fuel was in contact with concrete. And that was liberating hydrogen as well. Now, the NRC assumes that containments leak at 1% a day. So in a room this size, what we're saying is that the gases that are released would be about 1%, meaning over 100 days, the gases in this room would leave and fresh gases would come in behind it. But what the NRC said in a phone call on March 23rd, is that the reactors at Daiichi were leaking at 300% per day. That means that the gases inside Daiichi were leaving the containment every 8 hours. Whatever radiation was getting out of that nuclear fuel was being liberated to the environment within 8 hours because the containment leak rate was 300% per day, not 1% like the NRC assumes. Assumption number three is noble gases. Now, if you remember your high school chemistry, raise your hands if you do. I don't see many hands. Oh, I do. The far right of the periodic table is our noble gases, things like xenon and krypton. They're called noble because they don't react with anything. Nuclear fuel is loaded with noble gases, and as long as the fuel retains its integrity, the gases are trapped inside. Well, the fuel didn't retain its integrity, and all the noble gases were released. The data indicates that over Chiba, the xenon, which is a noble gas concentration, was 400,000 times normal immediately after the accident. And also that the concentration of xenon in Chiba was 1,300 becquerels per cubic meter for 8 days. Now, a cubic meter is about 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet. And think about it, inside every cubic meter of air over Chiba, there were 1,300 disintegrations emitting radioactivity every second for 8 days. What were those people breathing? Gases with noble gases, which can't be monitored now. They're gone. So I think one of the issues here is that the Japanese government has no idea how much exposure the people in Chiba got from this cloud of noble gases that were released. This is important data that just came out. Mainichi covered this story, but it's actually Fukushima Prefecture data, and it's only a couple of days old. There were four radiation detectors that continued to work after the Daiichi accident. Almost all of them didn't have power, but a couple were battery-powered, and they just recently discovered the data. Normal background on these radiation detectors was about 0.04 microsieverts. At 5 o'clock in the morning, right after the accident, the radiation in the detectors was 10 times background. 6 o'clock, 60 times background. 9 o'clock, 150 times background. 10 o'clock, 700 times background. What that means is that somebody in the vicinity of these radiation detectors was getting a yearly dose in 12 hours. Then the vents were open. So this is a clear indication that the containments were leaking well before the vents were open. So at 3 o'clock, these same detectors were measuring 30,000 times background. That means a yearly dose in 10 minutes for the people in Chiba. Now, it's also important to realize this may not be the worst. This happens to be where the detector was. But it doesn't mean that the plume chose to go to the detector and get that reading. This is a complicated slide, but it shows exactly what I did talk about here geographically. The one detector was here. Well, here's the plant. One detector was here. Here's its spike. Another detector was here. Here's its spike. Another detector was here. Here's its spike. So it geographically ties this data around. So it's clear that this plume was meandering all over the western side of the plant and the northern side of the plant, even before the vents were open. Also, one of the detectors continued to operate, and here's the spikes in the detector. There's no correlation between these spikes and when the venting occurred and when the explosions occurred. There's no correlation, which means that other phenomena had to be happening as well that scientists have not yet evaluated. Assumption number four, the decontamination factor for cesium, and I'm sorry, this is a little bit geeky, but the Nuclear Regulatory Commission assumes that after a nuclear accident, the water inside the torus, which is the donut at the bottom of the containment, takes out 99% of the cesium. That's called a decontamination factor of 100. That's actually written into law that they believe that to occur. But they also say that if the water hits boiling, there's no decontamination factor. The water is incapable of capturing any cesium. Well, the data from Fukushima shows that the water in that torus at the bottom of the containment did boil. Why did they boil? Because those cooling pumps I was telling you about that cool the diesel were also designed to cool the torus. So we had boiling water in the torus, and that meant that no cesium was retained. Now, the Japanese, as they're trying to reconstruct this accident, are claiming cesium was captured inside that torus, but the law and the data show that it couldn't be. There was no cesium deposition, no cesium retention inside the suppression pool. Now, how do I know that? This is an important slide. It's kind of blurry. It's an infrared image of Unit 3. The large blotch in the center of the screen is the spent fuel pool on Unit 3. That's here. And the temperature of the gases coming off the spent fuel pool are 62 degrees centigrade, which means that the fuel is boiling and it's mixing with cold air, and there's a bath of hot radioactive air over the fuel pool at 62 degrees. That's pretty bad. But what's worse is the flare that the drawing shows. Now, TEPCO's known about this for 2 years and has not talked about it. Nope, sorry. That flare right here is exactly where the containment should be. And that flare is at 128 degrees Celsius, which means it's not steam. Steam can't exist over 100 degrees. Engineers call this something in the steam tables, but at atmospheric pressure like we are today, when you boil steam, you're only going to get to 100 degrees centigrade. That flare is at 128 degrees, which means that it's not steam. It means it's hot radioactive gases being released directly from the containment. It also means that inside the containment, it was not below the boiling point of water. It was above the boiling point of water. There was no liquid water inside that containment. This is on March 20th, 9 days after the accident. The containment is venting hot radioactive gases directly to the environment. This is proof positive in my view. And TEPCO, obviously, they're good engineers, and they would have seen that 128 degrees centigrade, about 250 degree hot radioactive flare being released in this infrared picture. So they've known for a long time that huge amounts of cesium were being released directly to the air because they weren't being trapped in the water in the suppression pool. The last assumption is hot particles. This is me and Reiko, my co-author of the book we wrote in Japanese, taking a sample when I was in Japan in February of last year. The soil, I took five samples in 5 days. I just went to a piece of pavement or a piece of, one case it was a children's park right next to a school. The kids were playing right next to me, throwing stones like kids do. I took a bag of samples and I brought the five samples back, declared them through customs, and they were analyzed by Marco Kaltofen at Worcester Polytech. And each of the samples exceeded 7,000 becquerels per kilogram. What that means is in a 2-pound box of sample, we were getting 7,000 disintegrations per second of cesium in Tokyo, more than 100 miles away from the accident. Think about that. That's like, you know, New York City, Tokyo and New York City, roughly comparable as far as the importance to their nation. And 7,000 becquerels per kilogram qualifies as radioactive waste in the United States. So the people in Tokyo are walking around with spots that have radioactive waste. And I didn't go hunting for this stuff. It was right on the side of the sidewalk. This is an autoradiograph of a car filter in to take in. What that means is we had people, Fairwinds had people send us air filters. And one box arrived, totally unexpected. And as I approached it with my Geiger counter, the Geiger counter started to go off at 5 feet away. It was a car air filter. We took the car air filters and laid them out on an X-ray plate. Marco Kaltofen did at Worcester Poly. And these are the burn marks in the X-ray plate after the X-ray plate was set in a safe for several days. Fukushima Daiichi's on the right, Tokyo's in the middle. Those show hot radioactive particles trapped in the air filter. Well, people were in those cars. Kids were in those cars. If it's in their lungs, if it's in their air filter, it's in their lungs. I think it's safe to assume that the people in Fukushima City and the people in Tokyo had enormous exposure of hot particles directly into their lungs. We also asked for kids' shoes. This is the concentration of cesium on children's shoes. Kids tie their shoes. Kids eat with their hands. That's in their stomach, it's in their gut, it's in their intestines. I thought I'd compare what the available inventory of radiation was for cesium compared to Fukushima Daiichi. Now, these things are called petabecquerels or petabecquerels, and it's a whole bunch of zeros on the end of a number. The total available cesium at Chernobyl was 2.9 with 17 zeros behind it of cesium. There was almost three times more cesium available to be released at Daiichi 1, 2, and 3. We know for a fact that that 300%, three times more noble gases were released from Daiichi. There can be no argument about that. Now people are wondering how much cesium was released. Chernobyl shows that about a third of the cesium was released from Chernobyl. And Japanese experts are saying that, oh no, it can only be about 1% of the cesium was released, or maybe 2% of the cesium was released from Fukushima. I don't believe that's true. And I don't believe that's true because of the drawing I showed you before, where the temperature inside that reactor was on the order of, inside the containment, was so hot that there was no liquid water to retain the cesium. The Japanese experts believe that the cesium was retained in the water, but that infrared photo that I showed you earlier clearly shows that couldn't have happened. So I conclude that the noble gases were three times the releases of Chernobyl, and the containment leak rate was 300% per day. That's an NRC number. And that the decontamination for cesium was zero. Nothing was getting filtered out, scrubbed out in the suppression pool. The one good thing that Fukushima had Chernobyl didn't is that one side was water, and a lot of times the wind was blowing out to sea. But offsetting that was the last piece on the page, which is that the population density in Japan is a heck of a lot worse than the population around the Chernobyl reactor. And finally is the liquid releases. I really haven't had time to even talk about them, but they'll continue for years and years into the future. And we already know that the liquid releases are 10 times Chernobyl. The Tokyo has 35 million people in metropolitan Tokyo. And Prime Minister Khan said our existence as a sovereign nation was at stake. Now, I already know, I've taken the five samples that show that portions of Tokyo, all over Tokyo, were as radioactive as what we would have to send to a radioactive dump here in the United States. So I think the point is, at what point do the risks of a technology become unacceptable? Well, my conclusion is that sooner or later, in any foolproof system, the fools are going to exceed the proofs. Good. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that. Well, now you know why I'm a Luddite. I liked it when you could just get up, show a few slides, sit down again, and not be foiled by the technology. Arne Gundersen, thank you very much for a terrific... and scary talk. Now, David Lockbaum is going to talk about another unsurprising surprise.
Thank you, and thanks to everybody. Thanks to Helen and PSR for sponsoring this, and thanks to everybody for taking time today and hopefully tomorrow on this important topic. As it's not a surprise, today is the second anniversary of the disaster at Fukushima. An earthquake and the tsunami it fostered caused three reactor core meltdowns and forced tens of thousands of people to leave their homes. Next slide, please. Was it shock and awe, a tragic surprise that could not possibly have been foreseen and avoided? No. Do I do it? I don't have control. Do I? Okay, I'm back. Was it shock and awe? No, it was all shucks. It was a series of foreseeable hazards that just weren't dealt with responsibly that triggered the accident. The disaster began with an earthquake measuring 9.0 on the Richter scale. Not a surprising challenge. The Fukushima plant had been designed for severe accidents, and all available evidence suggests that all safety systems survived the shaking and were cooling the reactor core as intended. But the earthquake extensively damaged the electric power grid to which the plant was connected. When the plant was running, it's supplying electricity to the grid. When the reactors were shut down, it needs electricity from the grid to power the pumps, the motors, the dampers, the lights, and everything else that needs to cool the reactor cores. It had long been known that the grid was not protected against earthquakes even smaller than 9.0 and could fail. Forecasting that the grid might be lost, workers had installed more than a dozen diesel generators at Fukushima. One diesel generator per reactor was all you needed to cool the safety systems to prevent reactor core damage. The rest provided backup safety. When the earthquake took away the normal power supply, these emergency diesel generators automatically started and were providing power to the equipment needed to cool the reactor cores. In addition to taking away the normal power supplies, the earthquake also generated a tsunami that arrived about 45 minutes later. Forecasting that someday the Oceanside plant might experience tsunamis, workers had installed a seawall, protective seawall, around the plant that was nearly 15 feet tall. Unfortunately, the tsunami that day was nearly 45 feet tall. Years earlier, researchers in Japan had forecast that the site might receive a tsunami wave close to 46 feet tall. But the plant's owner and the regulator dismissed this foreseen hazard on the grounds that it was overly speculative and not substantiated. It's now been substantiated. No changes were made to the Fukushima seawall. The diesel generators for the three reactors operating at the time of the quake were located in the basements of the turbine buildings, the buildings closest to the waterfront. Tsunami water, scarcely impeded by the short seawall, inundated the site and flowed into the turbine buildings through open doorways and ventilation system louvers. The diesel generators stopped running as the water submerged them. All of the diesel generators had been placed in the basements of these buildings. This placement afforded the greatest protection against earthquake motion, but the least protection against flooding. Consistency is an overrated quantity. Inconsistency improves the chances that you're right some of the time, even if you don't know when that is. Put another way, diversity is your ally. If you mix up how you do things, chances are you're going to get some of it right, again, even if you don't know when that is. But the company put all of its eggs into one soggy basket. Forecasting that the electric grid might be lost and that the diesel generators might someday fail, workers had installed banks of batteries with sufficient capacity to power one safety system for up to 8 hours. But some of the backup power supplies were also disabled by the floodwaters, and the surviving battery banks were only capable of providing power for 8 hours. The plant was without power for 9 days. 8 hours is much less than 9 days. Forecasting that multiple safety systems might occur someday, workers had developed procedures for using backups to the backups and using diesel-powered pumps on fire trucks and barges to provide makeup cooling water to the reactor cores. But the pressure inside the reactor vessel or the pumps produced enough pressure only against one quarter of the pressure inside the reactor vessels. In other words, you needed to reduce the pressure in the reactor vessels for these pumps to be able to send water in. Forecasting that it might become necessary someday to lower the pressure inside the reactor vessel, workers had installed valves that could vent the reactor vessel and into the containment building and vent the containment building to the atmosphere. But these valves needed electrical power to work. Anytime you use a backup clock in the control room to tell you what time it is, you're in trouble. In cruel irony, three reactor cores at Fukushima faced the threat of overheating due to ocean waters that flooded and disabled the backup power supplies and the equipment they powered. The power loss also prevented workers from using the backup to the backup systems. Sitting literally a stone's throw away from the Pacific Ocean, a fairly large body of water, Three reactor cores face meltdown due to lack of water. Forecasting that reactor cores might someday overheat and melt down, producing large amount of hydrogen as the fuel melted down, workers had installed systems to purge the air inside containment and get rid of the hydrogen. Even before the plant started up, systems were installed to replace the containment air with nitrogen, so that as the hydrogen was released from a damaged core, it would mix with nitrogen, no oxygen was present, and it could not explode. But the accident caused the pressure inside the containment building to go very high and forced that hydrogen into the surrounding reactor building, which does not have nitrogen in it, except for the nitrogen that came from containment. So the same thing that caused the containment to fail caused hydrogen to get into places it was not supposed to be. There were instruments provided inside containment that allowed workers to monitor the amount of hydrogen, the amount of oxygen inside the containment, and to vent the containment when it became necessary. There were no instrumentation at all inside the reactor building to monitor the hydrogen or the oxygen concentrations. That was the first clue workers had that hydrogen was in places it shouldn't be. It's a little bit late when that's your clue that things are going awry. Hydrogen gas escaped from the containments into the surrounding reactor buildings. I went through that. That's the unit 3 that Arnie already showed. And the result was 3 reactor buildings, al fresco. No roof, no walls. Took a while to do that, too. It didn't happen all the time. With all these forecasts of hazards that were identified, the only surprising thing about Fukushima is that no steps were taken to manage the hazards. The warning signs were all there for many, many years prior to that disaster. One only needed to heed rather than ignore the warning signs. The 3 reactor meltdowns forced tens of thousands of people to evacuate their homes, and they're not going back anytime soon. The Japan Center for Economic Research recently estimated that the cost of Fukushima was somewhere between $71 billion and $250 billion in U.S. money, or U.S. dollars. It's not going to be our money. This includes $54 billion to buy the contaminated land of people who had to leave their homes within 20 kilometers, and $8 billion in order to compensate the residents. Even if the actual price tag ends up being at the low end of this $71 to $250 billion range, that cost far exceeds what would have been a prudent safety investment years ago. Had the electrical grid been fortified to withstand an earthquake, the continued availability of electric power would have prevented this disaster. They would have had electrical supplies for the workers to use any number of equipment that was already there. Had the seawall been raised so that the height was taller than the tsunami wave, the combined availability of the normal power supply and the backup power supply and the backup to the backup power supplies would have prevented this disaster from occurring. Had the diesel generators and associated electrical buses been located at some at high elevations, some at lower elevations, the likely availability of some of this equipment would have prevented the disaster that occurred. Had the battery banks been installed such that some of them would have survived the tsunami wave, and the rest of them would have lasted more than 8 hours, an artificially short period of time, the disaster would have been averted. Had workers been given a viable plan if all 3 of those things failed, the disaster would have been averted. The cost of all of these measures, had they been taken, would likely have exceeded $71 billion. The costliest item on that list, hardening the electric grid itself likely would have cost more than $71 billion. But it would not have been necessary to pay for all of the upgrades, or even the most expensive of those upgrades. All they would have had to do was pay for one of those upgrades, even the cheapest one, and we wouldn't be here today. Symposiums are not held to talk about disasters that have been avoided. If a taller seawall had been erected around the site, none of the other safety measures upgrades would have been needed. The taller seawall would have kept the tsunami in the Pacific Ocean instead of on the Fukushima plant, and the safety equipment would not have been flooded and taken off the table. Unless you'd have built the seawall with gold, it's hard to imagine that the taller seawall would have cost more than $71 billion. If each Fukushima reactor had been constructed with one diesel generator low and one diesel generator high, and provided air-cooled diesel generators so you didn't need the cooling water for the diesel, likely one of the diesels, at least one of the diesel per reactors, would have survived even the shorter seawall and prevented the disaster from occurring. I worked at a plant here in the United States that added an additional meat diesel generator. It was $100 million, considerably less than $71 billion. If each Fukushima reactor had been equipped with the means to reduce the pressure inside the reactor vessel and containment so that the diesel-driven fire pumps that were sitting there could have actually worked, the disaster would have been averted. Independent battery packs and compressed air cylinders is all they would have needed to get those valves to work. That's ultimately what they used, because they went out to the parking lot and took batteries out of cars and went to a contractor shop to get compressed air cylinders, but they got them too late, not in time to prevent disaster, in time to mitigate it. So all the hazards that factored into Fukushima's tragedy had been foreseen for many years and had fixes readily sitting on the shelf waiting to be installed. Severe accidents like the one at Fukushima keep occurring because nuclear plant owners and their owners keep pretending they cannot happen. Pretending is to protection like guessing is to knowledge. We have the capability to protect against these hazards. Nuclear power plants can be built and operated successfully against known hazards. We struggle against unknown hazards, but we have no excuse for operating plants vulnerable to known hazards. We only need to match our capability to handle these known hazards with the will to do so. When researchers concluded that Fukushima might experience a tsunami taller than its seawall, that should have led the nuclear plant owner and the regulator to evaluate whether we need to build a taller seawall or take other steps, like relocating emergency diesel generators or providing a reliable backup, so that something survives the tsunami threat that you know you're vulnerable to. It's okay to pick the cheapest from amongst those options, unless the cheapest is to do nothing against a known hazard. That's irresponsible. People should go to nuclear jail when they make those decisions. And you could have followed that process for any one of these hazards. Anytime the battery power was only designed to last for 8 hours, somebody should have answered the question, what happens at the ninth hour? If the answer to that question is we hope for a miracle and we distribute rabbit's foots, go back to the drawing board, come up with a different solution. That's the wrong answer to that question. The reason they didn't get a wrong answer to that question is they never asked it. The easiest way to duck a question is not to ask it. I had a department head in college who said it doesn't matter to have all the right answers until you've asked all the right questions. They didn't ask all the right questions, and they're paying a high price. So plant owners and regulators can consider setting a protective standard less than a known hazard as long as there's an evaluation shows that there's something other than luck and miracles that will step in to save the day. To further illustrate how this works in practice, consider for a moment if the disaster at Fukushima had been caused by an asteroid impact. It's unlikely that asteroid shields would now be being built around plants in Japan or elsewhere. The answer to that what-if question involves little changes at plant sites and likely involves more changes in our ability to detect incoming asteroids. How has Fukushima affected nuclear safety here in the United States? Some claim it cannot happen here. If the "it" they are referring to means the status quo that allows the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to pretend these things cannot happen, they are right. It cannot happen here. We're not ending that status quo, apparently. If the "it" refers to severe accidents, they are dead wrong. Prior to Fukushima, the NRC learned about a plant in South Carolina that could be flooded to a depth of 13 feet, a foot higher than Fukushima. The NRC's own risk analysis calculated there was a 100% chance that all three reactors at that site would melt down if that occurred. Very little has been done other than hide the documentation about this threat. A hallmark of nuclear safety is defense in depth, a normal and a backup system, a backup to the backup, to make sure that you have core cooling even if a single failure occurs. But when that single failure is underestimating the likelihood of severe accidents such that you take no measures to protect against them, you're setting yourself up for Fukushima. We've done this again and again over decades. There are no nuclear surprises. The only thing surprising is why we continue to do that. One of the definitions of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, hoping for a different outcome. It doesn't work. The technology is too unforgiving. So had Fukushima aimed higher on just one of the barriers I went through, just one, not all of them, just one, we wouldn't be here today. But more importantly, tens of thousands of innocent people would be back in their homes with their belongings, enjoying undisrupted lives. That's not the case. For them and for millions of potentially innocent victims tomorrow, we must do a better job protecting against known hazards. Thank you.
Okay. Well, David Lochbaum, thank you very much. I must say, if the rest of this conference has the same caliber as the talks we've heard this morning, we're in for a great conference. The second observation, I love that $250 billion figure. I would love somebody to take a bet, because it's going to cost them a lot more than $250 billion by the time this is all done. And you know, everything we've heard so far, all the dangers that they've just talked about are going to be profoundly amplified by climate change, aren't they? The final point I'd make is I wish it were mandatory that the members of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission attended this conference. Now, much to my amazement, we are really on time. So, it's coffee break, and please be back. We will start again promptly at 11:15.